This is Michael Welch. I'm a CKUW, and I have the great privilege and honor of speaking with Dr. Vincent Harding. Dr. Harding is Professor Emeritus of Religion and Social Transformation at Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado, and the author of many books, including Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero. And he is also the first director of the Martin Luther King Memorial Center. Professor Harding was also a very good friend and confidant and speechwriter for Dr. King. So, Dr. Harding, welcome to our show.
Michael, I'm very glad to be with you, and I look forward to our conversation.
Dr. Harding, you just yesterday evening you gave a speech, a presentation to a very eager audience of something well over about 300 people. There were 200 in the room, and there was or 200 and some in the room, and then about another 100 in a breakout room. So, what were your feelings about that presentation?
I was glad, for one thing, to feel the energy that was present when I walked in. I was glad to see the wonderful variety of human beings who were present. And I was glad for the opportunity that I had to experiment with something that I wanted to try out on that particular group, and that was to begin my presentation by asking them what they thought my topic meant, and by asking them for questions that they had growing out of what they thought it was about. And I am exploring at this point in my life as many ways as possible to encourage democratic conversation. And I felt that we had a good experience with working on that last night, and that people really were willing to be engaged in that process, which I think is an absolutely necessary process for the development of democracy in your country and in mine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and as you said, the it was critical to have a dialogue that's where real learning begins. And I was also there was a lot of very eager questions that came out throughout the evening. I do recall that one of the common themes that was brought out, I think it was by the first questioner, about Martin Luther King's dream, and how it's whether Obama is the realization of that dream. Maybe we could you could maybe go over that point about you mentioned when you were presented with that that we needed to revise the dream, and that not only that they had to be more than just that business about just being in fellowship and children going to school together and that. Could you go over that a little bit, and where we have to take the dream in 2009?
Well, Michael, I think the major point that I was trying to make was that we do King and ourselves a great disservice when we freeze him on the Lincoln Memorial space in August 1963. And our temptation is to take the easiest interpretation of what he was saying and to be totally distanced from the 5 years that followed that 1963 event. And I was trying to say that we do not understand Cain nor give him adequate reality if we don't move beyond 1963 and the dream speech to ask and learn about what he was doing between then and the time that he was assassinated, just 5 years after that. And of course, assassinated on April 4th, a date that's very close to the one that we are talking together in now.
It's tomorrow. And another important point about that date is that it's also the exact same date that Martin Luther King gave a speech at the Riverside Church in Brooklyn that, sorry,
New York,
right, that had to do with Vietnam. And it was a speech that you are credited with having drafted for him. It was the first major speech or public address that King had made on the subject of Vietnam. Would you care to share with us that the process and the significance of that speech?
First, Michael, let me make sure that we know that Martin King had been looking for ways to talk about Vietnam well before that speech. He had been actually raising his voice step by step, level by level, from the time of the March on Washington to 1967 there. So that was not a new position for him. He had been criticizing the war in passing as he talked about other things. But that speech came into being because King, by 1966, was deeply convinced that he needed to make a fuller and more organized statement about his reasons for opposing not only our part in the war in Vietnam, but for opposing our posture in the world of people's movements for change against the colonizing forces of the world. And what happened was that he received an invitation back in 66, around the summer or so, from an organization that had been formed by religious leaders like Abraham Joshua Heschel and others, called Clergy and Laymen Concerned About Vietnam. And they asked him if he would come to New York to that great cathedral-like church, Riverside Church in New York, where there had already begun to be a ferment of opposition to the war on religious grounds. They asked him if he would come there and speak. And it was clear to him at that point that that was the kind of occasion that he would like to take in order to make this fuller, more nuanced statement about his opposition to the war, so that he would not simply be a part of a general anti-war movement, but so that he could place his own religious, spiritual, moral stamp on his opposition. And he knew what he wanted to say. We were dear friends, and I knew what he wanted to say. And because of his mind-boggling schedule, he also knew that he was not going to have the time that he needed to put that speech in the kind of shape and form and order that he would like it to have. And so sometime in the fall of 1966, he asked me, and primarily it was through our dear mutual friend, Andrew Young, to do a draft for him. There was a whole background to why he asked me in relationship to what we had already shared on the matter of the war in Vietnam and on the necessity for those of us who were black in America to speak up on that war. And King asked if I would do the draft for him. It was essentially a draft that was calling upon his own commitments, his own ideas, his own desire. And that was essentially the speech that he delivered on April 4th, 1967.
It is an awesome speech. I know that when I first heard it, it really spoke to me, and I wouldn't say that I went out and became a peace activist because of the speech, but I think it did help to inspire me and give me a certain direction. I mean, there's so many parts of it that do seem to resonate, and I think it's not surprising to me that this has been listed as one of the greatest speeches in American history. And yet, in every retrospective I've seen of Dr. King, it's barely mentioned, if mentioned at all. So maybe you could, first of all, what does it say to you that, I mean, you mentioned earlier how about we shouldn't lock King in the Washington Monument with the I Have a Dream speech, but what does it say that that aspect, that frozen in glass, frozen in time moment seems to be the main, the way he is generally portrayed these days, whereas the transformations he was going through later on, not only with regard to Vietnam, but also the critique of the economic injustices that were taking place, especially in the North. What does it say to you, both as a pioneer of the freedom movement and as an historian?
Well, Michael, I've tried to speak to a great deal of that in my collection of essays called Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero. I think that as we so often do as human beings, we have taken from King that which we felt we could handle most readily. We underestimated our own capacity to handle tough things in the way that we human beings often do, and we felt that by the time that he was assassinated, it would be okay to speak loudly about little black girls and little black boys playing together with little white girls and little white boys. But even there, we gave short shrift to what King was talking about, even in that speech. And we forgot that he made a major critique of the fact that black people were by and large still trapped in what he called islands of poverty in the midst of the wealthiest country in the world. He critiqued the terrible uses of police power and brutality against black people. And he also spoke about the need for an urgent black protest to continue rising, accompanied by the connections to all the white people who understood that these were critical issues. If you read the March on Washington speech in its fullness, all of those things were there. And then, in addition to that, people were challenged to listen to Riverside and to hear King, for instance, calling our country the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Not our country, but our government. And that is not easily handled. King was saying in that Vietnam speech that the racism of America has to be dealt with and eliminated. In addition to that, he added the fact that he was always talking about toward the end of his life, and that is the fact of what he called great materialism and our abandonment of the poor. And then he spoke about our need to deal with the terrible scourge of militarism. Those, Michael, are not easy things for the faint-hearted to put their arms around. It is much easier to keep repeating, "I have a dream, I have a dream, I have a dream." But to take that deep critique of America's way of life was much, much harder. And so people dropped away from that and pushed that away from their minds and their memories and took the pieces of King that they thought they could manage in a sense that they could recreate in their own image, and they walked with that. And that is not adequate for deep understanding either of King or of ourselves.